Let's start. So I will tell about some recent work on heavy quarkonium in QCD. Sort of half of these papers are together with Ove, and so actually today I will try to give kind of an overview on the topic, and tomorrow there's another talk by Ove which focuses on somehow the most critical part, which is how you can define what is the proper definition of a static potential on the non-perturbative level if you want to use it for heavy quarkonium at a finite temperature, in finite temperature QCD. So, but today just kind of the overview. So now the basic idea is that we know that in QCD, one of the, quarkonium, by which I mean chamonium and bottomonium in particular, they are sort of, they have been a very fruitful system for learning a lot of precision things about QCD. There's a lot of literature, a lot of studies on the production of the spectroscopy and on the decays of heavy quarkonium. There's a yearly conference. There's a lot of theoretical work, but there's also a lot of experimental work, and really one can compare the two on a quantitative level. So it's an obvious question which was asked already more than 20 years ago whether one could also use this quarkonium system as a useful probe at finite temperatures to see how QCD behaves under those conditions. So now what I precisely mean by the quarkonium at finite temperatures is a little bit subtle, because of course in a finite temperature system you just cannot go inside there and look at quarkonium as such. You have to have some kind of a probe. So what one then means is that what we really consider the production rate of, say, lepton antilepton pairs from a thermal system. So for instance, here is this supposed to be a thermal system, and what can happen in this thermal system is that just by thermal fluctuations, there's a Boltzmann factor which gives the probability of creating a quark and anti-quark pair on shell. M will be, in my talk, always the mass of these heavy quarks. These two guys, they may be there in this plasma, they may interact, and then they could also come together and annihilate and produce a photon. Now, if they produce a photon, then this photon typically escapes from the thermal system because the photon doesn't feel strong interactions. It's an off-shell photon, it can propagate for a while, and then it can decay into a pair, for instance, a mu plus mu minus pair with some total four momentum Q. And now this is a system which is easy to observe for an experimentalist. It's one of the main signatures, just a lepton-antilepton pair flying away, measured in the detector. They can measure the number of this kind of pairs produced as a function of Q. And then you can plot this as a function of Q. And then it can happen, for instance, that you observe a resonance there. And that's then what we mean by quarkonium. There should be a quarkonium resonance in the production rate of these pairs. And we could, ideally, we could study as a function of temperature or as a function of the mass of this quark how this resonance structure in the production rate evolves, and then thereby indirectly learn about the behavior of this quarkonium system in a finite temperature. Now, just in parenthesis, I should say that I will assume that the state here to be really thermal. Of course, it's not one can ask the same questions also if there is some kind of a non-thermal state, anisotropic or whatnot. Also, of course, it's not there is also a contribution to the dileptone production rate from say light quarks. I mean, that's also possible, and it's a basic standard quantity which one computes in thermal QCD. I will just in this talk focus on the heavy quarks because basically because this makes the system somehow more tractable. There is this additional parameter, the heavy quark mass, which allows me to at least have one limit, namely the limit that these heavy quarks are really very heavy, where I can hopefully have the system under control.
So, but in that limit, this is exponentially suppressed with respect to the light quark.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exponentially suppressed, but still I expect to see there this resonance.
I see.
You know, that's the point. The signal is very small, but there is some structure.
I know you're not considering light quark, but is there some temperature dependence on those resonances? Or is
I mean, on the light quarks, you don't expect a resonance. You have just some kind of a shape there, and it's a very, you know, there is some.
But in some sense, the pions.
Well, I mean, I will consider temperatures which are above the, you know, a few hundred MeV. So I don't have pions or so, but I have certainly a lot of light quarks in the plasma, and then they produce some kind of structure which is very, can be very non-trivial, in fact, and there's a huge literature on how to compute it, and it's very difficult also because one has to do all kinds of resummations. Okay, so now Now one would say that since we understand the system very well at zero temperature, one would maybe naively expect that now taking the temperature to be non-zero should surely make things easier, because after all, asymptotic freedom at least says that at high temperatures the coupling should be smaller, and if coupling should be smaller, somehow we should be able to have a handle on this system. So it somehow, surprisingly enough, it turns out that this is not quite the case, but in fact most of the standard approximation methods people have used for studying this system, they appear to develop actually further systematic uncertainties at finite temperatures. Now these standard approximation methods, they are roughly the following. The simplest one is potential models. I'll discuss that briefly. Then there's lattice QCD. Nowadays certainly ADCS CFT. And then perturbation theory. So let me start with the simplest thing. The simplest thing, of course, when one thinks of quarkonium, it's like it's like the hydrogen atom of QCD. So we expect that there are these two heavy quarks. They move, but just very little. And then there is some potential which binds them together. And this binding potential is then what determines the properties of this resonance. Now, if we are in this deconfined phase, then there is no confinement. So there's no linear part in the potential, but there's still the Coulomb potential. And what the finite temperature now does is it takes the Coulomb potential. Coulomb potential, which would be just 1 over R. And the finite temperature, what it does, it debye screens the Coulomb potential. So one gets this kind of Yukawa type of potential where the MD is the debye mass. It contains the temperature, and then it's generated by interaction, so it also has the coupling there. CF is just a group theory factor. Okay, so now the simplest thing you can do is take this debye screen potential, put it in the Schrodinger equation. Here is the mass, and then look for bound states. It's a very simple problem. You can set it in a basic quantum mechanics course. And so, of course, we know if the debye mass is zero, there's an infinite set of bound states. But once you start cranking up this debye mass, then these bound states just start disappearing. And in fact, one finds that if the debye mass is larger than some number which scales with the heavy quark mass here and the coupling and then some kind of transcendental number here, then this system does not have any bound state solutions anymore. All the bound state solutions disappear. And that's what one traditionally then called the melting of this quarkonium at a finite temperature.
Excuse me, I know that many people follow this way, but I wonder whether it is correct to use Schrodinger equation.
Yeah.
And the system is not isolated.
Right, that's a very good question.
There are many particles flying just to screen the potential. So
yeah,
does it make any sense to use Schrodinger equation?
Yeah, that's a good question, yes. Okay, so we'll come, of course, back to that. So now what people then also do is not take this perturbative potential, but then some non-perturbative potential. Here are some examples of more recent work where this is the temperature in units of the critical temperature. This is the binding energy. And I just want to make a couple of points from here. The first point is you will see already that there are kind of many, I mean, even for a single state, say J psi, there are many different potentials here. That's one of the themes. Actually, at finite temperature, one can define many different potentials. And if you just take a potential model, you can ask if it's justified at all, but then at the next step, if you somehow manage to believe that maybe it's okay, then you still have to ask what kind of a potential should I use. The other remark is that if one takes different states, then these are kind of excited states, then they typically they melt earlier. So, of course, the lowest energy state solution exists for the longest, I mean, to the highest temperatures. That's the last one to go away. The higher excited states, they go away already earlier. So one discusses in the literature very much the not only a single melting temperature, but then several melting temperatures of all these excited states. And in fact, the Hebbian experimentalists, for instance, these days, what they want from the theoreticians is just some number for the melting temperatures, and then they put that in the Monte Carlo. And
how are these non-perturbative potentials?
Yeah, I will come back to that. Yeah. So now, of course, one can pose many questions here. I mean, even at zero temperature, which is kind of the well-understood case here, one can ask whether it's really justified to put some non-perturbative potential in the Schrodinger equation, because the Schrodinger equation itself is some kind of a perturbative equation. And, one has done it for a long time. One knows the results are good, but still this is a theoretical issue whether it's really justified. Now, nowadays, there is some framework where actually one knows to what extent it's justified. It's an effective theory framework which goes by the name of potential NRQCD. And in this framework, indeed, some potentials appear, but typically these potentials are not really say, non-perturbative potentials which one should take from the lattice, there are some matching coefficients which are only get contributions from the hard scale. So it's a complicated setup, but at least in principle it can be somehow justified at zero temperature. Now, at finite temperature, as already became apparent, there is certainly the further question, which, even if you believe in this, which non-perturbative potential to use, and that's, I'll come back to that then later. Now, the method which in principle is free of all these ambiguities is lattice QCD. However, of course, there's the problem that in lattice QCD we don't, so this production rates of the side lepton pairs, that's something which is really Minkowski time. We measure in real time how many lepton pairs we see. On lattice, everything is Euclidean. However, in principle, what one can do is one can take the vector current, that's the current which couples to the photon, measure the two-point correlation function of that on the lattice, on the interval one has, and then one can try to relate that to this rate. And now this rate is actually, it's proportional, I'll show the formula in a few minutes, to a quantity one calls the spectral function of this current. And there is, in fact, a relation which is valid on the non-perturbative level, which says that if you manage to measure this Euclidean correlation function as a function of the Euclidean time on this interval, then in principle it is related to the spectral function which we would like to know through this kind of an equation. And so now this one could measure, and then the task is somehow to invert this relation to find the spectral function. Now, I guess one immediately asks whether this relation really is invertible, and I guess one doesn't really need to think too much to see that in a strict mathematical sense, first for sure it's not invertible. However, this doesn't prevent people from going forward. There is some trick which one can use, and indeed there are actually a lot of studies where one does manage to find some spectral functions. Here it's a spectral function over omega squared, some normalization, and in different channels, so not only the vector, which is kind of the physical, but also pseudoscalar, axial, and the scalar channel, and as a function of the frequency, so somehow, somewhere here, would actually the first peak is supposed to be kind of the Quarconian peak, and then really it should then go down, and then it should increase to some constant, actually. The reason it goes down, then further, it's a lattice artifact. On the lattice, you cannot have more energy than is given you by the lattice spacing, so this decrease here is a lattice artifact. So in principle, one can get numbers. Now the problem is that, of course, there are all kinds of artifacts. So even at zero temperature, there are many the usual things: finite volume, finite lattice spacing, and quarks are difficult to treat without compromises. But then, indeed, at finite temperature, so even the limit that one assumes that one has perfect data in the infinite volume continuum limit, then still this relation I showed is not a Laplace transform. And so strictly speaking, it's not really invertible. Now, there is a method people use, it's called the maximum entropy method. It's a fancy word of way of saying that one puts in some more information, some prior. And the simplest way to say it is that one puts the prior at the free behavior of this, the behavior of this function at large energies where it should be perturbative. And then maybe this method then somehow allows to estimate it at moderate omega, yes?
So are you saying that if you knew the Euclidean correlator exactly, you still wouldn't be able to...
I don't think you can reinvert this relation without further. You have to know something about... For sure, you have to know something about the asymptotic behavior of this function, which you have to put in by...
Just think in Fourier space, you just have it on discrete sets of points about some R frequencies.
Yeah.
I mean, in the limit that you take...
But if I knew those frequencies and the value of the correlator exactly.
Yeah, no.
No, at least you need to have some, as you said, some behavior in the far distance.
Right.
I think there's a theorem by Mayadi and Testa that you cannot make this analytical continuation in the timeline direction. You have to be inside of the light.
So in the zero temperature limit, so beta goes to infinity, this actually is a Laplace transform. There, in principle, you can invert it. Of course, there you still need to go to complex plane and so forth, so it's not, even there, it's not trivial.
See, but if I know the large omega dependence, then I can invert it.
Well, I guess in principle you can. I mean, but this, the method what one uses here, it's not doing this inversion in a strict sense.
Yes, that's a conceptual level.
I think you can, if you know the behavior, large omega. Okay, so I mean, this means that the this means that one can get results and one can try to make all kinds of cross checks of whether the results are good or bad. But the fact is that it's not possible, for instance, to assign some controlled systematic error to the data point. We just hope that the results are okay and we can, and maybe they are, maybe not. Okay, then there's ADS-CFT. So I won't say much about this because I don't really know the topic too well. But certainly the same issues have also been addressed in this setup. So for instance, one finds in fact a lot of papers. In some papers, one this is the temperature in some units. This is the maximum J spin state which exists at the given temperature. So one sees that there is again some kind of a melting temperature depending on the J you take. And the numbers are not unreasonable in this case, so this is also something useful. And then one can also more directly really compute perhaps the spectral function done here. And this is the frequency, and then one maybe sees some resonances here and so forth. I think here they didn't divide by the omega squared, so it's gross, but in principle the structure it should go to a constant, so it's kind of similar to what I had before. So I don't want to say anything about the systematic errors here, but it's a method for sure, which is also interesting in this context. Now, what I really want to discuss is then perturbation theory. So now again, the basic thing to realize is that also with perturbation theory, actually things get a bit complicated at finite temperatures. So the reason is that perturbation theory suffers from infrared divergences at the finite temperature, and this requires complicated resummations. The way to say it is that actually I can still define a weak coupling expansion, but this weak coupling expansion is not the same as the loop expansion, as would be the case at zero temperature. But a certain order in the weak coupling expansion requires the infinite orders of loops. So concretely, this means that typical observable could have, for instance, this kind of a structure. So there is some quantity I can compute, and I can define a weak coupling expansion, but things can happen. For instance, there can be some of the resummations, they mean that there can be powers here which you would never expect to have at zero temperature, odd powers of the gauge coupling, or you can have logs or so. Even more radical things can happen here. For instance, there can be terms. There are examples of observables. Basically, every observable, if you go far enough, you will find a term in the weak coupling expansion where the coefficient actually is non-perturbative. The resummations we know of, they don't give us a way to compute the number, but we still know the number exists, and it, in principle, can be determined somehow.
Those coefficients are functions of G as well?
Or? No, these are numbers. These are functions of NC and NF, but no functions of, I mean, G I showed explicitly.
Non-perturbative in what?
Non-perturbative, it will become apparent in a moment. So that's kind of a theoretical problem, that this series is complicated. Then there's also a practical problem, that even if you would be able to determine this coefficient, then it oftentimes happens that the series doesn't, if you then plug in some realistic temperature, it could happen that the series doesn't converge very, very well. Naively, one could say that it's just because it doesn't go in G squared and the square, but in odd powers of G. So if G squared is not that small, then square root of G squared is bigger, and then the series is worse convergent. So now let me briefly, first of all, explain why the structure is, just remind why the structure is there. I think for many people in the audience, this is very well known, but one way to understand it is as follows. So let's remind ourselves what kind of momentum scales parametrically one has at finite temperature in QCD. So QCD, Young-Mills and quarks. If you just write the Lagrangian at the finite temperature in Euclidean space, then there's only one mass scale you identify, that's non-zero mass Barra modes with a mass multiple of 2 pi t. So suppose now I identify these modes which are kind of massive, and if I have massive modes, I can always integrate them out. So I integrate out all these massive modes. What do I end up with? I end up with an effective theory one calls EQCD, which then has the mass Barra zero modes. So it has three-dimensional Young-Mills, and then the zero component of the gauge field also remains there as a scalar field. It also has a zero mode. But what appears in this integration is that this scalar field actually develops a mass, and this mass is nothing but the d by mass I already mentioned. So it comes through integrating out these heavy modes. It has this the scale there, and then it comes through in loop, so it has a g in front. Now, once I have this theory and I see that there is a mass scale, I can again integrate out. Massive moons, I can always integrate out. So I integrate out A0. And then I'm left with a theory which one oftentimes calls magnetostatic QCD, which is then just three-dimensional Young Mills. Now, three-dimensional Young Mills, the coupling here is, so somehow the dimensions have changed, so actually the, one can scale fields and coupling so that the coupling effectively, as in three dimensions, must be the case as a dimension of GeV, so it's the old coupling times temperature. Now, three-dimensional Young Mills, however, is a confining theory. So therefore, one knows immediately that whatever one gets from these scales, it's non-perturbative, it's a non-perturbative number. And that's where these non-perturbative numbers come from, three-dimensional confinement. And then only does one get physics. So now, if one estimates the expansion parameter related to these steps, then the expansion parameter it has from the vertices at the chi squared, then if one writes the integration measure in finite temperature, there's always a factor of t in front. And then to make it dimensionless, you have to divide by some scale. And the scale now is the scale one integrates out. So in the first step, when one integrates out this non-zero Matsubara modes, then the expansion parameter is g squared over 4 pi squared or whatever, just like at zero temperature. It's an expansion in alpha s. But in the second step, for instance, if one is treating some physical theory by scale, then here is gt, and one of the g's cancels, so one gets an expansion in odd powers of g, and that's the reason for this. Well, the last step, really, if you just insert this scale here, then one sees there is no expansion parameter, it's a non-perturbative problem. So that's the reason for this structure. Now, concerning the practical convergence, I'm very brief here. So there, it turns out that issues depend, I mean, the answer somehow depends on the observable. There are some observables, probably everybody has seen this figure, for instance, of the pressure, it's a function of the temperature, to various orders in perturbation theory, and one sees that kind of doesn't seem to converge at all. So this is an example of a situation where one would say that perturbation theory doesn't really seem to show any significant convergence. However, there are other observables where things are not so bad. For instance, this is another, it's a quantity which is it's called a spatial string tension. It's a string tension related to a spatial Wilson loop. Now, that's of course a non-perturbative number, but the non-perturbative number in front of this guy comes precisely from the three-dimensional Young Mills. It's very easy to determine very precisely with lattice simulations. And everything else about this is perturbative, so one can still compute it to various orders in the weak coupling expansion just with these non-perturbative coefficients. And though it turns out that, for instance, in this case, these are lattice data, this is one loop and two loop in some sense, which I don't now want to go into. And so one sees that actually in this case, for instance, one gets down to very, very low temperatures and excellent description, unless the three loop goes somewhere off the scale, but this I don't know. So all of this is just to say we don't really know what the practical answer is, but at least theoretically we know that we can work to some order. We can work to any order if we want to, if we have enough time and resources. And so that's also then one method to try to determine the Speckle function. And so somehow the practical mindset these days is all of these methods, they have problems. And really what people are trying to do is just to somehow to compute the same quantities with many different methods, and then somehow hoping that they have complementary systematic errors perhaps, and at the end maybe one finds a consistent picture, which really is useful, because this dielectron production rate is one of the quantities one is measuring in the heavy ion experiments, for instance. Okay, so what I will do in the following is then just the last method, weak coupling expansion, and so in some sense it's just graphs, but of course one realizes it's not quite that simple. So in the beginning I showed this amplitude, what I'm producing from the QQ bar of photon. Now if I look at the rate, it's the amplitude squared, so somehow it's the current-current correlation function, it's a vector current, it's in this medium. And now we already know from zero temperature that if we are looking at this kind of a current-current correlation function close to the threshold of the production of these two quarks, then one has a lot of diagrams to resum to get the correct answer. And now things are even much more complicated because these gluons are propagating in the medium, so one has to somehow resum them, and it's a very complicated setup if one just tries to look at the graphs. So how does one then get this under control? Well, the way to do it is to think about the scales. So I'll try to explain a little bit the scales that appear here. Now this is somehow a very non-trivial. In some sense, this is already the answer to the problem from the theoretical point of view. So some of these issues will one can only justify later on, but I'll try to give the picture now. So the scales are roughly the following. So at zero temperature we have this heavy quark M, and if you have a hydrogen atom, then there's a Bohr radius that's the inverse of the momentum scale. So in fact in weak coupling one can say that the momentum scale is g squared times m, the inverse of the Bohr radius. Now parametrically this means that the momentum is much smaller than the mass, so it's a non-relativistic system, and therefore the energy is g to the fourth times m. And then maybe one can add additional scales. In particular, at zero temperature, one could add QCD, lambda QCD, and then one can ask whether it belongs here or here or whatever. So there are several scales already at zero temperature. Now at finite temperature, the additional scales, I already showed that there are at least these three scales which exist in the system. So now if we try to then discuss what happens to the system at the finite temperature, the issue somehow is one has to make a choice of how to now relate the temperature, where to put these scales here. And somehow physically, it seems to be the interesting situation that we take temperatures which are small compared with the mass. So the mass of the heavy quark charm or bottom, it should be a few GeV. And we are interested in temperatures which are a few hundred MeV. So one could, from this physical point of view, one could start thinking that maybe it's wise to take some temperature which is kind of small. So here are two examples. So first choice, take temperature which is of order g squared m, of the order of the momentum scale of the quarks at the zero temperature system. Now it turns out that in this case and this is somehow a formula which I don't think one can understand just like that. It comes from the results I'll show later on. But anyway, it turns out that the width of this quarkonium state in some sense is of order g to the 6 times m, while the binding energy actually remains parametrically of the same order as at zero temperature, g to the fourth m. So therefore one can say that at these low, very low temperatures, the bound state is somehow numerically the coefficients can be modified from what they were at zero temperature, but parametrically the bound state still exists, just like at zero temperature. However, if one increases temperature, in particular if one takes temperature of order gm, then it turns out, again from the formula I showed later on, that the width has increased significantly to the cubed m, while the binding energy, the coefficient certainly changes, but parametrically it's still, if I would be able to take g very, very small, then parametrically it still scales as g to the fourth m. And so somehow, therefore one sees that the width is parametrically larger than the binding energy, and somehow one can say that the bound state has melted. So this is somehow the theoretical justification for this picture of melting of quarkonium.
So here you're only comparing T to M, but shouldn't also you compare it to the decontaminant temperature?
Yeah, right.
Which is lambda QCD, which is lambda.
Yeah, yeah. So this T is still, it should be larger than the lambda QCD. Assuming it's larger than the lambda QCD.
Mikko, how much? So to what extent you really have the separation of the scales?
Yeah, I mean that's then another issue, of course, and it's very difficult to, you know, when you start to discuss numbers, then you have to add somehow pi's here and maybe 1 over pi there and numerical factors, and it's I don't think it's possible really to do that like that. I mean what you do is you first have some theoretically consistent computation. You try to do it then to various orders. And then you can see then you start decreasing the temperature such that G increases, and you try to see how long you can do it in some consistent way. But I think that's something we can only judge after the computation.
But suppose you have an M of GV, your G will be close to 1.
Yeah.
Or maybe 0.1.
Yeah. So somehow
0.1 squared, then your temperatures are already below the.
So somehow, let's say, I mean, along these lines which I mentioned, one can more or less then convince oneself afterwards that for the bottomonium system, things should be more or less under control. For the chamonium, it's certainly pushing things to the limit. Okay, so now let me try to explain kind of how this all this arises. So now I have to show some formulae. So first of all, the observable I wanted to start from is this production of, say, mu plus mu minus as a function of the for momentum q and then per volume element. Now the first step is trivial. It's just taking care of the photons and the lepton of the final state kinematics of these photons and the leptons well, of the lepton pair which flies out. And so in fact there is a formula which just contains the muon mass and the Q, and it's a simple derivation, which then relates the non-trivial things to a certain Green's function. Here there's a Boltzmann exponent, which is just the Boltzmann exponent I showed before, and then there's a certain Green's function. This Green's function is a function of this Q, and it's a Fourier transform of a two-point function of the vector current. The vector current, here I'm so considering now the contribution to the vector current from the heavy quarks. This is the electric charge. And the excitation value here is the thermal excitation value. This is a QCD Hamiltonian. And so it's really a quantity where both temperature, so somehow imaginary time, and then the time, so this T is Minkowski time, appears here. So it's one of these real-time Green's functions. Incidentally, the spectral function I mentioned before, it's related to this C tilde larger by a certain kind of kinematic relation. Okay, so now this is the Green's function I want to compute. So there's just an appendix which reminds all these different Green's functions, and so I'm considering this C larger. Then there are, of course, the usual retarded advanced time order and so forth, and then also what one usually has in thermal field theory are these Euclidean ones, so that would be just the same as this one, but with a Euclidean time C tilde where you don't have any eyes. But now I'm really, this is what I really need. Okay, so now I want to compute this Green's function at large M. So now there is a following trick one can do to try to compute it. And this is that I take basically the same Green's function. I set the momentum, the spatial momentum actually to zero, just to simplify things a little bit. So this means that the muon and the mu plus and mu minus, they fly in the opposite directions. It's not a great restriction. Also one can relax it, but let's just do it. And then I take the spatial average. So the spatial part of the Fourier transform, I keep the time here, not yet. I didn't transform the time yet. And the trick I do is now I somehow point split the vector current a little bit. And somehow the idea is that one kind of wants to come to this kind of a Schrödinger equation. So one has somehow one gives some freedom for the quarks to move. So this means I have here this the vector current at time t and point x, but now I split them a little bit by an r, and then I may put the Wilson line in between if I want to keep it gauge invariant. And the other time at time zero, I also split by an r prime. So this is just a tool, it's not physical. So at the end of the day, when I want to come back to the Green's function, I have to set this r and I prime to zero and take the remaining Fourier transform. But the reason why this is convenient is that if one, for instance, looks at this Green's function just in the free theory, then one realizes, like this physical intuition already suggested, that this kind of a Green's function actually does satisfy something like a Schrödinger equation. So in fact, in the free limit, it satisfies exactly the free Schrödinger equation one would like. It's an expansion in 1 over m squared, and also one can see that in the free limit there is then some, it's time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and then one has some initial condition, and if one solves this equation with this initial condition, then one gets the correct result, and takes r and r prime to zero, one gets the correct.
The result doesn't depend on the Wilson line.
No, it doesn't, because at the end of the day, I mean, in the free limit, for sure not. In the free limit, you don't even have them. Now, it's a tricky question what happens to. So then you can analyze to at which orders, I mean, whether it's non-perturbable independent of that or only to some order in perturbation theory. It is a very trivial, a non-trivial question. Yeah.
So M is dimension full. So what's really the dimensionless parameter that controls this expansion? With the corrections, for example, or the 1 over m cube is m cube?
Oh, it's higher orders in derivatives. Oh. I mean, here, yeah. And then, of course, at the end of the day, these derivatives get replaced by, for instance, by the, one of these scales which I had before, for instance, the g squared m.
So that's basically the size of the bounds.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, this converts somehow to the weak coupling expansion.
But this is a free Schrödinger equation.
Yeah, exactly.
You make a wave packet, which is a delta, and it just starts spreading.
The point is now that, I just tried to convince you that it's a good thing to look at. Now, of course, I want to look at it in the interacting system.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so now the argument to make it short is the following, that I have this Schrödinger equation. Now, there is an expansion in 1 over m, but there is no real symmetry actually associated with this expansion. So one can also add additional terms in the expansion, and obviously I will then define my static potential to be the term in this exact Schrodinger equation which does not scale with m. So it's just some term here which happened to be zero at leading order. But in the interacting system, in fact, even on the non-perturbative level, you could say there is room for this guy. That's my definition now.
You don't need any gradient expansion under this equation?
Well, it is a gradient expansion in, it's an expansion in 1 over m. But I mean, it's in principle 1 over m expansion. You could also formulate non-perturbative. It doesn't, you don't, at this point, you don't need to refer to perturbation theory.
But the higher order terms are not just involved C fiddle, they involve gauge fields, other things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, they will.
Really an equation for C.
Well,
Right.
I mean, of course, here, it's an expectation value, so they don't really involve gauge fields. They involve only derivatives of...
They involve
higher derivatives. In principle, they can... Yeah. Right. I mean, I should say, to really justify all these things, one has to go through effective theories, NRQCD and PNRQCD and so on. I'm trying to take sort of the shortest path, but it's not the most rigorous, for sure. But I think at this order it works out. So now the point is to follow. Well, one point is now the following. I mean, once you convince yourself that such a structure could appear, then of course you realize that now at this moment this guy is independent of. I mean, that's by definition. It's independent of M. So let me send the mass to be to infinity. The reason why it's a useful thing to do is that then the heavy quarks, which appear in my Green's function, they become essentially just Wilson lines. They don't move anywhere. And so, in fact, the Green's function I had here, basically the Wilson the quark propagators here, they get replaced by Wilson lines, and the whole object becomes essentially a Wilson loop. Well, I have to take the R and R to be the same. It becomes a Wilson loop, and the only tricky thing is that I have to be very careful about this time ordering. So this C larger, actually, compared with the Euclidean Wilson loop, it could be obtained as I showed before. It's related to the certain Euclidean guy, but then the argument in the Euclidean guy has to be analytically continued, and in fact. This guy here in this limit is related to the Euclidean Wilson loop, but analytically continued. Okay, so this is somehow a little bit, one has to think about it a little bit. Well, suppose you buy it, then you realize that, well, okay, there is this term which, of course, diverges in the limit that mass goes to infinity, but this term is kind of trivial because I can always redefine the guy such that in the time derivative just kills this guy. And so essentially, what I need is a Euclidean Wilson loop, analytically continued. And then I can impose this equation, and if I know this guy, I can read the potential here. Then afterwards, I could put the guy here with a finite m and try to solve the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so now let me very briefly say something about this different static potential. So in the literature, there's a huge amount of different static potentials one defines at finite temperature. The simplest things, for instance, you take two Polyakov loops, correlate them, you can define it to be, usually one causes the free energy, but I can just call it the static potential. Over t as a function of the distance. This is the time, and this is the distance. But this is by no means unique. Another example, I could take a Wilson loop, which wraps around once, take a trace, and define another guy. Now, at zero temperature, in other words, if the extent of the time is much larger than the confinement scale, then all these guys are equivalent to, they are equivalent because if this guy is larger than the confinement scale, one doesn't see what happens at the ends. But at finite temperature, it's not difficult to see that these two guys are, in general, completely different. In perturbation theory, for instance, one could figure out a smaller R dependence, and one finds they are completely different. Well, it doesn't stop there. People also, then one can also do other things at finite temperature. For instance, sometimes one says that one shouldn't take a free energy like here, but one should take some internal energy, carry out a Legendre transform or whatnot. So there are many, many different definitions one can give. All of them are, well, many of them are independent. And so one has to, if one wants to use a potential one has to then decide which one of them to use. And so what I was now trying to argue that in the setup where one starts from somewhere and tries to really derive what kind of a potential one should use, actually what one ends up is something different. One should first have the Wilson loop as a function of this Euclidean time. CE as a function of Euclidean time, then one can carry out the analytic continuation if one knows this guy analytically, and then one can impose this equation and one gets a potential. And it's not a priori clear whether this potential is related to any of the other potentials or not. Okay, so that's somehow, in some sense, that's the main part of the talk, to try to define something. Now, once one has...
It also goes over to the right static potential.
Yeah, so... Yes, in the zero temperature limit, it goes to the right one, yes. In the zero temperature limit, somehow, things don't matter really, because... This. Okay, so now... Now, having defined it, let me then give the results for this guy. So one has defined it, and then one can compute it. And as I already said, one has to resum loop. So technically, this means one has to use this hard thermal loop perturbation theory. And one can compute it. And there is kind of a surprise, which is that the object I defined, actually, it's complex. There's a real part, and there's an imaginary part. I take here this object at the limit of infinite Minkowskian time. So the static limit, but in Minkowski's time, not in Euclidean time. And so then there is the real part, and the real part has a structure which one is familiar with. So this is just the Coulomb potential I already showed before, just d by screen. So that's fine, that's what one expected. There's also a constant term, that's also fine. In fact, this constant term is nothing but it's kind of a mass correction for the heavy quark, and the value one has here is also coincides with twice the known mass correction of a heavy quark dispersion relation at the finite temperature. But then there is this imaginary part, same power of g squared, same group theory factor t, then some function which is given here explicitly. It's some simple function. It has some name, but the name is some Meyer g function or so, so it's not one of the standard functions. But anyway, it's a function which is just finite, takes values between 0 and 1, some function here.
Is it related to Friedel oscillations?
It's related to Landau damping. Okay. So let me now... Well, these are just some appendix on how to compute. I mean, it's really the only complication is that one has to do this resummation, which means that one has some kind of corrections in the gluon propagators, and then one computes the standard graph, so it's really a straightforward computation. Now, let me discuss the physics of why there is this imaginary part. The real part I already explained. The physics of the imaginary part is the following. So one has these two heavy quark and heavy anti-quark, and then they are bound together by these gluons, which are almost static. They're off-shell. Almost static. So now, if you have these off-shell almost static gluons in a thermal plasma, then they can essentially disappear. This is the phenomenon of Landau damping. And a way to understand it is that I can have these gluons, and they can scatter from particles in the plasma, for instance, quarks. Well, of course, I can also produce them from scatterings. They are off-shell, so there is nothing wrong with the kinematics here. Now, at zero, if you take the amplitude squared, at zero temperature, they are the same. So this doesn't really happen. They cancel. But at finite temperature, one knows that if one carries out the computation, the end result is more or less a Boltzmann equation. And so one knows that actually you can take this amplitude squared, but then you have to multiply this by the initial state. There's a fermion, there's a boson, there's a Pauli blocking factor for the final state. And in this case, there's a fermion in the initial, there's the Pauli blocking still in the final. But there's 1 plus NB for the boson, which is now in the final. So this guy doesn't, it's a non-zero result. There is this imaginary part, and the off-shell gluons, they can lose energy to hard particles in the plasma. It's the phenomenon of Landau damping. Okay, and so what this means somehow physically then for this quarkonium is that really in a finite temperature system, the interactions that one shouldn't think of the quarkonium as a static object there which lives forever. I mean, these guys can come together and stay for a while, but then after a while the gluon somehow scatters somewhere and the guys fly apart again. Okay, so now after all this, I now want to then just show some practical results. So I now take this. Oops. I take this potential.
So that term is what gave you that time in the first slide?
Yeah, this imaginary, this width, exactly. Yeah. I now take this potential, I plug it here. I solve the equation with this initial condition I had. And then I, after the solution, I set R to zero. So that means I evaluate the wave function at R equals zero and take the Fourier transform, and then I get my results. So here is an example. What is plotted now is this, indeed, the spectral function normalized by omega squared, like on the lattice, as a function of omega. So it's such that the 2 times the mass is here at zero, so it's the threshold. And this dotted curve here is the free result. In the free result, there's also a structure. The spectral function is zero if the energy is smaller than twice the mass, but if the energy is larger than twice the mass, then you can generate this free pair of a quark and an antiquark, and so there's a threshold there. And now with this potential, it tries to bind them together. There's an attractive part, but then also there is the width, which gives the structure a width. And so this is a low temperature. At the low temperature, one does see a clear resonance. At zero temperature, one would see many, many resonances. At this temperature, which is not very, it's already above the deconfinement temperature, one does see just one resonance. But then when one increases the temperature, then the width increases, the binding decreases, and then indeed this peak structure disappears, and one gets just some enhanced threshold at high temperatures. So now there is nothing really new in this structure. I mean, in fact, this is qualitatively just what Matsui and Zatz proposed more than 20 years ago, from certainly very different arguments, just phenomenological arguments, but still the qualitative structure is the same. Also, the numbers are, to the extent that you trust them, they are not really that different. They are within somehow 50 or 100 MeV from what people kind of expect from potential models or lattice. And so the basic statement is that all these quarkonium states, they do melt. Somehow the resonance disappears at temperatures which are somehow, say, 2 times TC or around those, could be a bit smaller, could be a bit, this is actually kind of botonium. So here one has a higher temperature where the computation is also more reliable. So now finally, then one kind of interesting physics observation from here. If one just looks now at the spectral function, then one would say that, yes, you have this quarkonium at low temperatures, at high temperatures it melts and you don't have anything. But now one has to remember that, of course, in the real physics observable I was looking at, which is this dielectron rate, there is this object I was plotting before, but then there is this Boltzmann factor, which also appeared in the formula. So actually, of course, this Boltzmann factor has a huge effect on looking at things, because the omega is more or less fixed. It's 2 times the mass, but then there is this exponential depends on the temperature. So actually, here things kind of get reversed. Here is a small temperature, and a small temperature is very, very highly Boltzmann suppressed. It does have this resonance peak here, and then the spectral function goes to a constant, but the Boltzmann factor lets it decrease further. So one has this structure, but it's very, very low. It's difficult to have a feeling for these numbers, but somehow it's a small number, 10 to minus 24 or so here. While if one now increases the temperature, then the peak disappears from the spectral function, but this threshold structure still remains. So in fact, even if one goes to temperatures where there is nothing particular in the spectral function, then because of this Boltzmann factor, first of all, the overall magnitude of the production rate is much, much higher by almost 10 orders of magnitude, and then still there is some kind of peak. So actually the intuition one sometimes has that once the quarkonium melts, then that this C and C bar or B and B bar don't have any effect. That's just not right. I mean, you can still generate this C and C bar or B and B bar from the thermal fluctuation, and whether they bind or not, it doesn't really matter for this guy. They can be just free guys, but they still can come together and produce the photon. And in fact, that's very, very much more likely than getting some from the resonance. You still get the structure. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. So I wanted to convince you that the useful definition of a finite temperature real static potential is non-trivial. And I was trying to convince that this one guy, which somehow originates from a physical observable, might be a good thing to do. But if you buy that, then there is a lot of physics also in it, which you didn't expect. For instance, the fact that this guy has an imaginary part. And then somehow using this guy, it turns out that the existence of a resonance and also the disappearance of a resonance in this quarkonium spectral function is qualitatively a weak coupling phenomenon. Doesn't mean that it's quantitatively correct, but at least it's, I find it kind of comforting that this very important physics is also captured by this method. So somehow it gives more confidence that all these different methods, which all have their problems, they might be looking at the same thing after all. Well, there was this issue that there is no really no stationary wave function, but the bounced state is short-lived transient, and really I shouldn't want to sell these as quantitative results, but one has to certainly compare with the other methods, and also hopefully, ideally, to work to higher orders to have some gauge on the convergence of this computation. Okay, thanks very much.
What is the experimental situation?
Yeah, I mean, there, well, I think, so at CERN there were all these NA, whatever, 50, 60 or so, which were really looking at this precise thing, but somehow it, and they get a signal, but it's very, you know, it's very difficult to be quantitative with these things. Also, in one of the RIC experiments, there is a measurement, there are papers on the production rate, but somehow, at the moment, things are kind of not on a very quantitative level. I mean, people are looking at them, and hopefully, yeah, hopefully things will be more quantitative in the future. I'm afraid I cannot say much more about that.
One question: if the party line is now that this matter is strongly coupled, so does this physics change in any way? Somewhat? It is really just.
Well, I don't know. I guess if you, can say that maybe there is strong coupling, maybe the binding potential is stronger, but also maybe the width is larger. So I think the physics in itself, on the qualitative level, it's not really. I mean, it comes from interactions, and whether these interactions are weak or strong, that's it's just a word.
Isn't that somewhat, I mean, if you're discussing
I would expect that
that's
that is.
Not really bottom part is not really relevant to the quark-gluon plasma.
Right.
It's
just
but they are very abundant, yes.
Yeah, and so it's, in itself it's not relevant, but it just happens that still, even in this case, the gluons which give the structure in the resonance, they are, of course, relevant. They are sensitive, and so it's just a good probe somehow.
You said that the physics behind your calculations is very similar to that suggested long ago by Zatta Matsui, but your quantitative results show something very different, because it was first was believed that J psi melts immediately after temperature slightly above.
Yeah, I mean, this is related to what I showed in the very.
Let me finish only. But and it was also believed that the peak in the electrons should disappear completely, and you first showed that JSA survives even to quite high temperatures, but even when it melts completely, there is still peak in. So it seems that from such a practical point of view, it seems to be a very bad signal of anything qualitative happening in Hebbian collisions.
Well, I mean, I guess. Yeah, I mean, but on the other hand, you know, the signal here, for instance, it's exponential, the scale here. So if you manage to measure something, a signal.
But you still see a peak, so.
And you see some peak, and you measure the just the magnitude of the signal, then it, in some sense one can say that it's a thermometer of this system, for instance. You know, it depends very, very strongly on the temperature. So if you have a signal here, whether the shape is this or that, I mean, whether you just have a signal here and you see some structure such that you can identify with the quarkonium contribution, then the absolute magnitude already tells you a lot about what kind of a temperature you might have achieved. I mean, of course, it's a very idealized statement, but in principle, there is it's a very strong information about what went on.
But I think that I wonder whether experiment is sensitive to it, because experiment always measures this comparing to Drell-Young processes.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, in principle, it's, well, I mean, all the temperature, well, yeah, I mean, I, of course, it's, whenever you discuss experiment, it's a very, very, long story, and many other things come in the picture, so I cannot really give a very good answer.
What is the argument in this function phi that cover and Severus see?
It's the d by mass times the distance, so it's just the same as appears in the usual Yukawa factor of the screened potential.
Okay. What is the reason that you have the same, you know, because, you know, one, if one looked at QED, usually the argument is you worry about the Debye and not about the imaginary part, because the imaginary part is higher in coupling. So why?
So, right, here this result is would also go through in QED. It is also there. But I mean, you have to compute it in the correct way. With hot, you have to first of all define this thing, then compute with the hot thermal loop, and it's still there. So that's, the physics is basically just the same.